Today on The Third Degree, we're looking at the health effects of living near an aluminium plant, electronic waste, and the latest surprising update for coal seam gas in inner Sydney. The Third Degree is 2SER's Environment and Social Justice Half Hour, and I'm Jessica Minchell. Since the mid-1990s, the Western Australian towns of Wagerup, Pinjarra and Kwinana have gone head-to-head against the American aluminium producer Alcoa and the Western Australian government. They allege that aluminium refineries in their neighbourhood are directly responsible for various sicknesses in their communities, ranging from bloody noses to respiratory cancers. A class action was mounted in 2009, backed by Erin Brockovich and Queensland's Shine Lawyers. Third Degree's Cameron Whalen reports.
American metal giant Alcoa has enjoyed great success in Australia since it built its first aluminium refinery in 1983 in the Western Australian township of Wagerup, about an hour and a half from Perth. Since then, it has expanded across Australia and in the area, building more refineries in the towns of Kwinana and Pinjarra, making Western Australia the single biggest source of aluminium in the world. However, throughout these years, it has been dogged by accusations from the towns, claiming that pollution from the refineries has caused illness among citizens and workers at Alcoa. Residents of the towns have reported skin and eye irritations, headaches, nosebleeds, and nausea. In 2009, Queensland's Shine Lawyers escalated the case, mounting a class action against the company's headquarters in Pennsylvania. Since then, the case has been thrown out of court, with the ruling that it should be pursued in Western Australia. But despite these claims, there have been no findings which suggest a causal link between the actions of Alcoa and the illnesses of residents and employees. Anna Breed is secretary of the Alumina Widows and Workers Union, a group she started after her husband John died of sinus cancer in 2002. She says the worst of it was when fumes would come through the air conditioning and into the break room.
There was nowhere to go because it was, if you did go to the crib room, you were exposed anyway.
What was John's role? What did he do at the plant?
Oh, he was an operator, or a serviceman, as you could call it. But for 10, 11 years, he did descaling, which is the hardest job on the plant. And you'd actually go down inside the tanks and with a jackhammer, and you'd actually manually jackhammer off the scale that was on the side of the tanks. There's these massive tanks that you can see on the plant, those huge, great big round things. They're hot and there was no ventilation. And it was just like going in a sauna, you know, and it was just like shocking.
So when did you first start to, or when did you first notice that John was becoming ill?
Oh, he's coughing mainly, just the coughing and just the tiredness. But then he did this for 24 years. But he was the third person on the shift to get cancer. There was 15 people on the shift. And so then John got this unusual sinus alveolar cancer. And, so he actually died in about 10, 12 weeks. It was very fast. God, we hardly had any time at all.
And then after he passed away, you formed the Alumina Widows and Workers Action Group.
Yeah, because I knew that there was... that. Well, you see, the boys actually kept a list of who was sick. And John told me about this list when he was alive and he was well. He said, oh, it was an ex-union official, kept a list of everyone that was sick. And I thought, well, you know, that's strange doing that, isn't it? Because really, Aussie blokes are normally pretty tough and, you know, don't like doing documenting illness, you know. Yeah, I thought, oh, no, there's something going on.
HealthWise is an independent group formed to study the health of Alcoa employees, comprised of researchers from Monash University and the University of Western Australia. Created in 1994, it brings together data from Alcoa Australia's inception, routinely submitting its findings to medical journals. Professor Malcolm Sim is director for Monash University's Centre for Occupational and Environmental Health and also a researcher for HealthWise.
There were some concerns raised about one of the refineries, and in fact one part of the refinery, in particular the precipitation area in WA, and the health department set up an investigation process for that and requested us to do some analyses. And I think this is the strength of doing these kinds of prospective studies, where we're able to do analyses when specific concerns come up. So we're able to focus down on a particular area, a particular site or a particular area of the site and do some subgroup analysis. that, we did quite a long report, which we looked at this in a range of different ways and provided those results back to the health department. I mean, you mentioned that Alcoa is the only one who's taking part in this prospective study, and that is the case. When this was first proposed back in the early 90s, there was approaches made to other aluminium producers as well, but Alcoa was the only one who went ahead with it and put this in place. So our focus in this study is the workforce. We're not doing any studies of communities around there, although many of the people in the surrounding communities do work at the smelter. So our focus is just the workers.
And just to finish up, so of course your work focuses on all employees, past and present of Alcoa. So as to those employees who have passed away from cancer, will there be significant research done on them? And then time will tell whether or not their cancer can be linked to Alcoa.
Oh, indeed. This is the strength of doing this type of longitudinal study is that once somebody is in the cohort, is in the group of workers that which is being followed over time, all of the information about that person, whether they develop cancer, what they die from if they are deceased, is included in the study. We're looking forward to presenting those findings and getting that out to the workers because there is a lot of interest within the industry and also in the broader community about the findings of these sorts of studies.
HealthWise will be meeting in the coming months to review their data on Alcoa employees.
The Third Degree's Cameron Whalen reporting there. And Alcoa declined to comment for that story. And now to the issue of electronic waste. E-waste is still being illegally shipped out of Australia, contributing to the growing problem of e-waste dumping worldwide. Federal Environment Department figures as at April this year are that 3 shipping containers with some e-waste, that's televisions, computers and monitors, were intercepted on their way out of the country this year. A new national e-waste scheme will start here in July, and in the lead-up there will be a series of stories here on the Third Degree about e-waste. The Pan-African Forum on e-waste was held in Nairobi in March this year. Tatiana Terekova, Program Officer with the Secretariat of the Basel Convention of UNEP, the United Nations Environment Programme, was there. She is in conversation here with the Third Degree.
Of course, Basel Convention also is a part of the UNEP family as well, but this is a legally binding instrument which regulates the transboundary movement of hazardous and other waste. And when we're talking about e-waste, sometimes people ask us whether it's hazardous waste or non-hazardous waste. Basically, under the Basel Convention, e-waste can be both hazardous and non-hazardous. It depends whether it's contaminated with various hazardous components and substances like mercury, for example. But in general, when we're talking about e-waste, it's assumed that it's hazardous waste because, electronics includes various complex components which have hazardous substances, precious metals, rare earth metals, just metals, plastics, and so on. So normally when we're talking about e-waste, it's hazardous waste. That's number one. Number two, since it's a hazardous waste, then it's a subject of the control procedures under the Basel Convention when it comes to the movements from one country to another. That means that countries or parties to the Basel Convention have to comply with certain procedures, and the country of export and country of transit and country of import have to agree explicitly to this movement. And if they agree, then this movement can take place. So it's the fastest growing waste stream compared to other waste streams. And in 2006, the parties to the Basel Convention adopted a so-called Nairobi Declaration, saying that countries need to take measures and action to address these challenges related to the e-waste.
What are the specific challenges African nations face with the issue of e-waste?
For several years, African countries have been suffering from the ongoing flows of imports of used and end-of-life equipment, electronic equipment, into their countries. And then it's very often associated with the illegal traffic of e-waste. That means that those containers which are sent from developed countries to Africa, they don't follow the Basel rules. Often those goods is declared as goods, used equipment, and that means that Basel Convention would not apply. But then the containers arrive to Africa, could be that up to 80% are the equipment is in a non-working condition. For example, if we take Ghana, in the recent years, we can say that up to 80% of the electronics which arrived to Ghana as import, it was used equipment. Also, within the used equipment, you have different categories. The equipment can be fully functional, it can be non-functional but repairable, or it can be non-functional and non-repairable. And that means that it goes directly to the informal sector. And this is also something very specific, I think, to Africa, although also it happens in other developing countries as well. But in Africa, you have very developed, let's say, informal sector. These are those people who are not registered. Sometimes these are scavengers. Sometimes these are small groups, like associations, but they're not registered as a company or civil society organization. And they're often involved in the collection of the e-waste, in the refurbishment, in the recycling, and the practices which are used are quite alarming because, for example, when it comes to recycling, what usually the informal sector does, they burn the cables, they burn the cases of computers just to get rid of the plastics and collect the metals, let's say copper, aluminium, so they can sell it to scrap metal facilities. And those practices are very dangerous for the health of their health, but also the health of the people nearby, and also very harmful for the environment. Because when you burn the plastics, you have the emissions of the furans, and these are very toxic substances, which actually travel across borders, and you know sometimes they just end up in countries which are really, really far away.
Are there particular major hubs for collections of large-scale e-waste?
Yes. In general, we could say that Ghana and Nigeria, currently, they are the main hubs for imports of used and end-of-life electronics in Africa. If we look at the volume of the e-waste generated in Nigeria, it's 1,100,000 tons a year. And of course, Nigeria, it's the biggest country in Africa with a population of 150 million people. And if you look, for example, to Ghana, Ghana generates 180,000 tons per year of e-waste. So, of course, considerably smaller, but this is just because of the size of the country. But also, if we also look at into the other countries, for example, Côte d'Ivoire. In Côte d'Ivoire, you have 15,000 tons of e-waste generated. So you see that the volumes are really, really different. Nigeria is by far is the largest country which generates the e-waste. And also because Nigeria and Ghana, they receive this ongoing flow of imports of used computer equipment.
It's not only the e-waste being generated from those nations, but also the e-waste that's being imported from, say, the global north.
Right. And actually, this is quite important issue because I think until now, what you would hear in the media is that Africa is a dumping place of old electronics from Europe, from other places. And then you really need to control or put focus on the enforcement of the Basel Convention, you know, on this transboundary movement. But I think now I think there is a understanding that, yes, of course, there is imports, but also Africa is a place where you have a tremendous growth of the use of the ICT equipment, of other equipment, and African nations, they have ICT strategies to use ICT for education, for the government services, and so on. So to close this digital divide, so-called, Africa needs this equipment. Now I think there is a recognition that Africa is also generating e-waste from the equipment, which is of good quality or maybe new. So, and there is a need to put in place a system, the proper system for refurbishment, for recycling, for resource recovery. At the forum, I think that was really clear recognition that there are two sources of e-waste, domestically generated and imports.
So this forum was the Pan-African Forum on e-waste, which was held in Nairobi in March. And this was actually the first such meeting about e-waste to be held in Africa. How significant do you think that was, and who attended that forum?
Basically, from our side, as the Secretariat of the Basel Convention, we're coordinating the project, E-Waste Africa project, for in the past 3 years. And our thinking was that we need to, since we generated various data and results, and we wanted to share this this information with other African states. At the same time, the government of Kenya was also very active in the issue of e-waste. And in 2011, they organized national workshop on e-waste, which was a big success. At the same time, we also work very closely with with our colleagues in UNEP, in the headquarters, as well as the private sector. And that was, I think, was something quite different maybe from other events, because we had a really true demonstration of the true cooperation between various stakeholders. And we had very strong support and participation of the private sector.
Sorry, yeah. By that you mean, say, computer manufacturers?
Exactly. In particular, those who participated in the preparation, it was what we call them OEMs, which is original equipment manufacturers. And we worked with HP, Dell, Nokia, and also with Philips in the preparation of the forum. However, at the forum itself, we had approximately 180 people, and 20 African governments. We also had a few governments outside of Africa. We had 13 intergovernmental and UN organizations, agencies, 14 academic institutions, 22 civil society organizations, and 22 private companies. And those private companies were not just, this included these manufacturers, but also we had few recycling companies, as well as telecommunication companies, and few others.
So with such a large meeting with so many different countries and organisations and companies present, was there much contestation about the best way to approach the issue of e-waste at the forum?
Maybe there were differences of opinion, but and also I personally was expecting, maybe some difficult discussions. But in general, I think somehow those various groups agreed on the key issues which are necessary to find the solution to e-waste in Africa. I think one was which came out was the need for the regional approach. Of course, you also you need to work on the national legislation as well, and that everyone was very clear about that, to better implement the Basel Convention, but also to develop a separate legal framework to address specifically e-waste. But what was, I think, clear is that countries need to follow, to somehow have a harmonized approach, because if this will not happen, then the problem will shift from one place to another, from one country to another. Then another issue was, of course it's all related, was the fact that African states do not want to be, a dumping ground of e-waste. But I think what they recognize is that sometimes there is a need to move the e-waste between the countries within Africa, or from Africa to developed countries, to Europe, because there are components which cannot be treated without big investment facilities. So it was not something new, but it was a recognition of this issue that basically not all African countries can have a recycling facility in place. And if you don't have this facility, then you cannot ensure environmental sound management of e-waste in your country. Maybe some components you can recycle easily within your country, but some other components you can send it to your neighbor. And sometimes from the economical point of view, it would make sense as well. So there are those discussions which took place, which were really, really important, I think, to understand really various aspects of e-waste management, not just, well, of course, aspects related to environment, human health, but also economic aspects. And I think also what I heard personally myself, that some countries want to lead this work, let's say in Africa, and they want to also attract more investment into the recycling sector. They want to promote the green economy and the green jobs, employment opportunities. So this, because this e-waste issue, it's not just a problem, but it's also an opportunity.
That green job would be in terms of recycling plants for the e-waste, is that correct?
Exactly. And there you have, of course, you have the collection, and as I mentioned, currently the informal sector is very much involved in the collection, and also the recommendation was that you should not create a parallel system to collection, because informal sector is very efficient in a way. Like, for example, if you take Ghana, the collection rate in Ghana is over 90-95%, which is significantly higher than in Europe. But this is just the way this collection system is structured.
And that's Tatiana Terekova, Program Officer with the Secretariat of the Basel Convention, speaking there about e-waste in Africa. St. Peter's residents were surprised last week when energy company Dart Energy decided not to pursue coal seam gas exploration and drilling in an industrial landfill site. This decision was announced only days after Marrickville Council used its planning powers to try and block CSD activity, despite Dart Energy having state government approval for exploration. The Petroleum Act does override council zonings, and these challenges to the conditions of consent are challengeable in the Land and Environment Court. It is still uncertain what Dart Energy is planning to do with the petroleum exploration licence they hold, which covers almost 2.5 square kilometres in Sydney. Greens councillor Max Phillips from Marrickville Council spoke with Third Degree's Tewa Razaghi.
Marrickville Council has been concerned about coal seam gas exploration ever since we learnt from a front page of the Sunday paper that a gas company wanted to drill for coal seam gas at St Peter's. We were, I think most councillors were flabbergasted that someone would want to drill for gas in a dense residential area. So council expressed its concern back in, I think it was October 2010, about coal seam gas. Since that time, the local community has built quite a head of steam and a big campaign about the issue. And certainly, I'd say the majority of our local residents are aware about the proposal, and there's widespread concern about coal seam gas in general, and particularly at that St Peter's site. We had the opportunity at a council meeting a couple of weeks ago with the conditions of consent for the Dialer Dump business operating on that site in St Peter's coming up for renewal, and I took the opportunity to move an additional condition of consent which essentially prohibited all exploration and production of coal seam gas on the site.
And is this landfill site anywhere near residential areas?
There's some residences down near Sydney Park, and Sydney Park's just across the road from this site. And then there's quite dense residential in St Peter's, within a couple of hundred metres away. And I guess the other concern for council and for residents is, with coal seam gas, you don't really get just one well. In order to produce, they essentially need a grid of wells across the landscape, a few hundred metres apart. So if this exploration well had been successful and it was producing gas, then the concern was they'd want more wells and be looking at other industrial areas or other areas of open space in order to drill more wells.
And did council vote unanimously?
Yet council was unanimous in its decision to implement this new condition of consent, which prohibits coal seam gas. It's not really a political issue. I think everyone's looking out for the interests of local residents, and really it's a no-brainer. You don't want a residential area becoming a what could be a toxic gas field. I think that's a no-brainer. It's surprising that the exploration licence was ever granted by the state government. Surprising that the new state government, which made some noises which were good before the election, has done virtually nothing about the licence that covers not only St Peter's but the entire Sydney metropolitan area. And there's other licences covering parts of the Sydney water catchment. So given the lack of action at the state government level and the federal government through Martin Ferguson, the Energy Minister, Energy and Resources Minister, really pushing this industry, council filled that void and represented the interests of residents by implementing this condition.
It's actually interesting because Dart Energy announced only days after council banning CSG exploration that they were not going to go ahead with coal seam gas mining, and in fact they never were. Is that true?
Look, I don't think that's true. I think DART has been a bit loose with the truth at times. I think they have been changing their plans as they go along. Certainly, I remember looking at some documents they'd put to the Stock Exchange in the middle of last year, which indicated they'd be drilling at St Peter's in September, October 2011. And I think it was the fact that the residents got engaged. There was a few big public meetings where I think the company realised that this was not a popular idea and that they'd face some real troubles to try and go ahead with the drilling. I think then they delayed it. They were talking about, well, we're not going to drill in the immediate future. We're going to look at maybe 2013, 2014 when we're going to drill. But it was only last week when they did make that announcement to the Stock Exchange that they've said that they were not going to drill at that St Peter's site. There's always been qualifications before that time.
And after this motion has been passed in council, is St Peter's safe from further coal seam gas exploration, or will council pursue further action?
Look, that's not clear. Council has very limited jurisdiction over gas or mining. The zoning down at St Peter's is an industrial zoning that actually prohibits mining or extractive industries. However, the Mining and Petroleum Act in New South Wales overrides any local environment plans, and that's how they got permission to drill at St Peter's. So for that licence, which is PEL 463, which covers the entire city metropolitan area, the only place that they actually have permission to drill is at St Peter's. So they will have to be looking for putting in an application to drill at other sites in that Sydney metropolitan area. If they're not going to drill at St Peter's, or they're going to have to give up that petroleum exploration licence. But I will say, I think the community is so united on this issue and people have been very active that I think any gas company that came down to St Peter's and tried to drill and tried to move in some drilling trucks and equipment, I think they'd face quite a lot of opposition, probably some direct actions, and I think it would be too much of a headache for any gas company to even contemplate that.
That's Marrickville Councillor Max Phillips speaking with Third Degree's Tewa Razaghi. You've been listening to The Third Degree. The podcast for this show and previous stories are up on our website at thirddegree.org.au. I'm Jessica Minchell, you're on 2SER, and Steph is coming up next on The Daily. Thank you.